Okay, thank you. Before I discuss the new work, I want to discuss more general ideas, in particular two ideas where I think, where I want to orient you to the way that I think about these things, and maybe that'll be more comfortable for some of the mathematicians, I hope so. In any case, I have to explain how I think about them before I can explain the new work. And those two topics are about certain funny terms, you might say, in actions and effective actions, and also how I think about p-form fields. And so to orient you towards that, let me just make an analogy in a way that let's think about two different ways we might think about tensor fields on a manifold. So one way is the way that certainly I think was probably the only way available in the last century, is that you think of tensor field as something on each coordinate system you have a collection of functions, and when you change between coordinate systems you have that those functions change by definite rules. Another way that we've learned to think about tensor fields is as sections of some global vector bundle. Now each way certainly has its advantages. Thinking about local coordinate systems and local formulas is often computationally the way that you'll discover things. On the other hand, you discover rather different things if you think about the global topology of vector bundles. And in this century, that's led to things like characteristic classes and much more subtle things having to do with that global topology. Even last century, I suppose, if you just think about a vector field on the two spheres, two functions which transform in a certain way, you might be hard-pressed to see you can never find one with those functions non-zero everywhere. So what I want to do in that spirit is offer you how I think about, first of all, effective actions, and then in the course of that, p-fields, p-form fields. So in an ordinary action, we might have a field, and then we have the Lagrangian, depending on the field. And for each field, so this is purely classical, for each field, this is a density on some space-time, and the action is then just the integral of that density. And so in particular, this is a real number. Now that's no problem. I can't really tell you much new about that. And if this field has gauge invariance, then you always say that one of the fundamental principles is that the action should be gauge invariant. Now, unfortunately, when things get a little bit more complicated, that principle gets a little bit abandoned. And so you write down something which transforms under gauge transformation, and if it does, then you say you have an anomaly. But I prefer to have a different point of view, which is instead of abandoning trying to write down a number which is invariant under gauge transformation, if you can't do that, you write down a number which changes under gauge transformation. I would rather write down something which is invariant under gauge transformation, but abandon that it's a number. So it's a slightly different point of view, but for me it's much easier to think always about gauge invariant objects. Now, there are three places where, at least I know, where we run into actions which aren't numbers and where we have to abandon it. The first one is where this is the only one of these which is quantum that I know about, which is at one loop when you have the determinant, the effective action for either a fermion, which might be spin 1/2, or it might be a Rita-Schwinger spin 3/2, or for a boson, which is an anti-symmetric tensor field. And of course, that's the story of anomalies, and that's very well known. But let me just review it quickly. So, for example, for a fermion, we might have a term in the action, which is the typical psi Dirac psi term. Perhaps we have another field, A, maybe a connection, and it depends on the connection like this. And if we integrate out the fermion, the effective action, something you might write as e to the I, the effective action for the boson, is the Pfaffian of this Dirac operator. Now, the Pfaffian doesn't make sense depending on the situation. The Dirac operator might map one type of spinner to another, and it won't make sense in a gauge invariant way as a number, but rather it's an element of some line, the Pfaffian line. And as we vary the other fields, so we have some space of fields, in this case the space of fields A, for each point we get this Pfaffian line, depending on A. And so as we move, we get some Coffee and line bundle over this space of parameters. And the this effective action is a section. The Pfaffian A is some section. So the picture, rather than getting a function, your effective action being a function on the space of fields, it's a section of some line bundle instead of a complex function. So the line bundle is a complex line bundle. Well, in the picture here, I'm not giving you too many details, but let's think of Euclidean and compact to be concrete. And certainly I want to think about Riemannian and compact for what I'm about to say, which is that this isn't very good as a effective action, because the next step in the program would be to integrate this over that space. And so the standard story is that, well, we have to trivialize this bundle. Now, there may be points at which this thing vanishes, and so that means this isn't a non-zero section, and so actually we can have non-trivial topology here. So it's very important that in this kind of system, this one-loop thing, we've done some infinite process that might generate this non-trivial topology. And that's, of course, given by the Attias-Singer index theorem, and you can compute the topology by that. And so if this bundle is non-trivial topologically, then we can't possibly trivialize it. So the goal, I should say, is to trivialize it by finding some base section you might call the function 1. And then the effective action is something you would call the ratio of these two sections, which would then be an ordinary function, and that's something you could then integrate. You can't integrate sections of line bundles. You can't add them. But, well, you can only integrate that ratio. So we need to find a non-zero section. And so there might be a topological obstruction, but even if there's no topological obstruction, that doesn't, it's a rather flabby problem just to try to find that. And so you need some geometry. And so the geometry is that you have a metric constructed by Quillen and a connection, which Bismuth and I constructed in the general case. And you also have the important thing, it's very canonical, so it behaves under symmetries, gauge invariant in particular. And you also have a local formula for the curvature in terms of the index theorem and the geometry there. And the anomaly in that context is really the non-triviality of that geometry. So in other words, if that geometry is trivial, then the picture up in the total space is that we have a connection which is flat. And so that means that if I think of the horizontal planes of the connection, that I can actually find a section which is tangent to those planes. And because of the metric, I can ask that section have unit size. And so that means on each component here, that section is actually unique up to a face. Now, in some problems, actually picking those phases on different components, I think, enters. But that's what you would mean by defining the effective action. You would find this section, which is flat for that connection, and that connection then tells you how to make that into a function. And so then you would say the anomaly vanishes. So the anomaly is really the non-trivial geometry there. So what you want to do in your effective action then is multiply together all the different contributions, which might come from several places. And then the action, the effective action will be a section of that bundle. And then you see if this composite bundle, this tensor product of all the different pieces, has trivial geometry or not. And then you finally take this ratio. Okay. Now, one thing I like about this point of view is that when you compute this curvature for this type, and then there are two other ones, it's a perfectly general formula. It doesn't matter what kinds of parameters we have here. So whatever the space of parameters is, we can always calculate the anomaly once and for all. We don't have to consider separately different sorts of directions, different transformations. Okay. Now, of course, there are other points of view on anomalies which are quite important in different contexts. Now, what are the other two types of terms that occur? And both of those will be actually what you might say is tree level, or classical term. And one type of term occurs on a space-time with boundary. And the other type, also at tree level, is on a closed manifold. And so this type, this is, for example, the type of term which occurs in the Green-Schwarz anomaly cancellation mechanism. Now, the second one is quite familiar, and the simplest example is just in electrodynamics, where if we have alpha, which is a gauge field, and if I have a curve C, which you can think of, or let's call it W, actually, which we can think of as the world line of some particle, then in the Lagrangian that couples these, you write down the integral over W, alpha. Now, if we think about, of course, if we represent alpha by one form, then this is just a number, the integral. But if we think of it modulo gauge invariance, then we might think of this as a connection on a circle bundle. So T is the unit size complex numbers, the circle group. And if we think of this as a connection on a circle bundle, then first of all, if W is actually a closed loop, then by this we might mean the holonomy. And this is, of course, not really a real number, but it's only defined up to integers. So it's an element of the circle. Yeah. So really, this doesn't make sense. The only thing that makes sense is e to the I times that. But that's OK, because that's what you want to put into the path integral anyway. So on a closed manifold, we might already run into things which aren't real numbers, but which are only defined up to a shift, this sort of topological term. But if we have a boundary, and our path W looks like this, then what this should mean is the parallel transport. So again, that sort of action isn't a number, but rather it's an element of a line. It's the line of maps from whatever the fiber is here to the fiber there. So I go back and forth between circle bundles and Hermitian line bundles. Now that's okay, usually, when you do the path integral, because what you want to do is fix the boundary conditions. And so then, if you think of that on some space of fields, if you have fixed boundary conditions, that line is absolutely fixed. So then you're integrating something with values in a fixed line, and of course that's okay to do. That's really saying you have this flat connection, so you have a way of identifying them all. So normally when you do the quantum field theory on a manifold with boundary, that's not anything to worry about as being an anomaly. But then you see something interesting when you vary the boundary conditions. But we'll actually meet this sort of term in the example, where we have this sort of term, Simon's term, but we'll see that we pick something up, but it will be essentially on the closed manifold. Okay, now in higher dimensions, of course, this is also familiar with Chern-Simons terms. So this is the sort of first example of a Chern-Simons term, where a Chern-Simons term, for example, in three dimensions, if you're on a closed manifold, it's again a well-defined real number modulo integer shifts, whereas if you're on a manifold with boundary, it takes values in a line, and the line depends on what's happening just on the boundary. Well, I'll say that again in a little bit. Now, notice, by the way, that, again, we're taking this exponential. So we get in this holonomy, or in this parallel transport, we get something which has norm 1. And so if we look at this over the space of fields, our section, our effective action, is a section with norm 1. In particular, it's not 0. So we can never generate anything topologically non-trivial by such a term, because it comes together with a section. And the same will be true here. So if you're interested in canceling anomalies, and there's some topology around, you can't possibly hope to cancel it by these sorts of local tree-level terms, because you can never generate anything topologically non-trivial. Okay. Now, the third type of term, as I said, is this tree-level term when M is closed. And the examples I know for that involve the p-form fields. And so before I can show you an example of that, I have to talk about these p-form fields. So a p-form field is something that, as far as I can tell, you don't really have to meet somehow until you're in dimension at least 6, because in lower dimensions you have duality between forms, and you can always, for example, in 5 dimensions, a 2-form field, which you might meet, is dual to a 1-form. So when p is bigger than 1, you don't really have to meet these until dimension 6, and therefore they're met in theories of, well, in 5 dimensions, the field strength of a 2-form is a 3-form, so the Hodge dual is a 2-form, which is the field strength of a 1-form. So a two-form is dual to a one-form in five dimensions. So if you had something with two forms, presumably you might be able to rewrite it in terms of connections. So it's really in dimension six that you might first meet them, and those are then in supergravity theories. That's why some of us never met them for a long time. Now, okay, so let's look at an example. So the simplest example is just a one-form field. And so one-form field is a connection. And the gauge invariant object is, of course, the curvature. So omega is the curvature. Now, this is a closed two-form. So in this discussion, I'm just thinking of M as some manifold, high enough dimensions so these forms aren't trivial. And this is a closed two-form, of course, the curvature. And taking units in which 2 pi is 1, this thing has integral, and also I is equal to 1, I should say, because for me the curvature is purely imaginary, but I'm afraid that the square roots of minus 1 are usually left out. So in any case, the periods of this are integral. So this thing has integral periods. So it's really square root of minus 1 over 2 pi times that, which has integral periods. And that means that when I integrate that over every 2 cycle, say 2 sphere or surface in my M, I get an integer. So typically, this might not be exact, and we cannot write omega equals d alpha for some one-form alpha. I mean, we can't solve that equation. On the other hand, it's not a general closed form because of this integrality. Now, if whether we know or not this global condition, we might try to write it as something exact by the following procedure. So we take our manifold M, and now we make an open covering. So we cover it by open sets, UI, and we cover it by very small open sets in such a way that the U's are contractible. And not only are the U's contractible, but any intersection of two of them is contractible, and every multiple intersection is contractible. And we use a notation UIJ is UI intersect UJ, and so on. And so we make a little table where, going up, I have the degree of the form, and then I keep track of forms on different open sets. So, for example, something here in the table means a one form on the intersection of UI and UJ, and what it really means is a collection of one forms, a one form on each intersection as I and J run over all the indices, and it's skew symmetric in those indices. So we start out here with the global form omega, which is a global form. So in this chart we have a differential running this way, which is just the ordinary d of the exterior calculus. Now, because these open sets are very small, we have the Poincaré lemma, which says I can find a one-form alpha I such that on that open set I can solve this equation. So I can't solve it globally, but of course on an open set I can solve that equation. Well, that's very nice, but we haven't achieved our goal because on these intersections we have, of course, different forms. So what we want to do is look at the difference and see if the difference we can write is d of something. And now it'll be d of some function. So the difference is a one form on the open set. I should have said this one form is closed because, of course, d of each of these is omega. So the difference is closed. And so again, since the intersections are small, I can write it like that. So we find these functions, g twiddle I j. And so in a way, this is a process of trying to trivialize this by writing it as d of something. And, well, we have nowhere to go because now we could try on a triple intersection to compare these g's, but we're already at level 0. We're at a 0 form. So what we can ask is, what if I take g twiddle ij, g twiddle jk, g twiddle ki? We can ask whether that's equal to 0. So I guess I'm adding here. Sorry. And actually, if this form is exact, then that will be equal to 0. But this form isn't exact, so in general, I won't get 0 for an arbitrary closed form, and I won't succeed in writing it as d of something. However, this form is assumed to have integral periods. And because of that, if I take gij to be e to the g twiddle, in other words, reduce these modulo 1, then in fact, this thing will be closed. So this thing will be closed, and I'll explain the horizontal arrows in a second. So this is, again, the arrow d. This thing will be closed if I take this to have circle values. So the important thing is that I change this bottom row instead of thinking of real-valued functions as being circle-valued functions. And then something with integral periods I can actually trivialize. So without changing the bottom row, this is a picture of what's called the Chek-Duram complex. It was introduced in a famous 1952, I think, paper of André Weil. It's an old idea, which he used to show that Chek cohomology and Duram cohomology are the same. In fact, he also, in that paper, compared singular cohomology and other cohomology theories. But here we've modified it by taking circle values at the bottom. Now, when we do that, we've introduced, so to speak, some topology at the bottom, and that sort of anchors it in a different way and changes very much the flavor of the complex. These horizontal areas, arrows are the standard Chek differentials. And what you do, it encodes the combinatorics of what you do when you start to compare things on these open sets. So we might solve some equation, write a field strength as being d of some gauge field on each of these small open sets, but then we have to see how far off we were on the intersection. And then if we correct that, we might have triple intersections to worry about, and this complex is exactly doing that. So what it says is that if the thing has integral periods, so in this complex we have a vertical arrow d, a horizontal arrow we might call delta, and we have a total arrow which is just delta plus d. And there are some signs there, Rawls really, in order to make d squared equal to 0. Okay. And in that sense, we can write that omega is equal to d alpha. So that's something we did succeed in doing. But where now alpha is this sort of a guy, gij alpha pi. These are one forms, and these are 0. But 0, remember, means a map from whatever open set it is into the circle. Now, of course, that's a very familiar picture, geometrically, of it's very easy to interpret this sort of object in standard terms. So the gijs are functions on these intersections, and they're transition functions that you can use to glue together a circle bundle. These are one forms on each open set, and those are local connection forms. And the equation that we got 0 there meant that alpha I minus alpha j is equal to d gij over gij, because now I've exponentiated. So that's g inverse dg. That's just the standard way a connection form changes when you make a gauge transformation. So in other words, something like this represents exactly a circle bundle with connection. And it's presented by really saying you have local trivializations over each open set ui. And so over each open set, we can compare the trivializations. That's the gij over the intersections. And we can pull down the connection form. That's the alpha. So this description I've given you is very much like I said with tensor fields, that we've given something, so to speak, on each coordinate chart and saying how they transform. It's that sort of description. The description in terms of a global circle bundle with connection is very much more to my liking. That's the one where I really have a space and a global description. Now, I'm going to tell you about higher p-form fields, and the frustration is that I'm going to give you this description in local terms, which probably won't be such a frustration for the physicist, but I can't really give you this analogous description. I could say a lot about it, I think, but I don't think it'll be terribly helpful to try to say that and get to the physics. I mean, there are things to say, but it's a rather complicated object which plays the role of that for the higher p-form fields. So we'll think of them in terms of this complex. And so, again, just orient you once more, supposing that we did a higher dimensional example. So for example, we might start with omega, which is now a 4-form, which is again closed with integral periods. And you might think of omega as being suitably normalized trace f squared for some connection. So in other words, this is something like a first Pontryagin form. It's a Chern-Weil form, which represents some characteristic class. And so again, this omega is some global form that lives here. And now we want to try to write omega as being the field strength of some 3-form. And again, using this complex, we can do it. So on each open set, we just find an omega I, such that D is that. And then we see what the differences are, and we correct it by a 2-form, so that the right thing there is 0, and so on down the line. And at the bottom, we get functions, which we have to take in the circle, not as real functions. And then we will actually find that that makes a cocycle. So this is then a degree 3 object in my total complex, and it's an antiderivative for this omega. So you can think of this omega as a field strength, and this whole object in this complex as being some kind of gauge field, just analogously to how you think about it here. Notice, by the way, everything's abelian. There's nothing non-abelian here. Yeah.
Yes.
I will. Yes. I will call it C field. But you didn't want to just ask about changing omega to C. Well, in some... I'm sorry, capital omega would be G and little omega would be C.
Well,
yes. Right. Well, that's, I'm afraid, what I'm trying to tell you, as you'll see. Yes? Yes, so I'm getting to that, right. Okay, sorry. So I should say that this idea of having, you know, a term you might use in Lagrangian, or maybe some related ideas, sorry, I didn't look up the paper, of writing something like this and then trying to construct actions, is in an old paper of Orlando Alvarez from about 84 or 85. The sort of germs of these sorts of ideas are in a paper there. Okay, so what this suggests, so as I say, considering this type of complex has the advantage over global forms that we can solve such equations. We can write antiderivatives for forms, closed forms, which aren't exact, but rather have integral periods. That's really the point. So what it says is that we should consider, as a, if you like, a generalization of the Derome complex, we should look at the total complex here. So let's let omega, gamma, I mean, and then capital D, this is the total complex. So an object in some gamma P, or P minus 1, will be a chain like that, which runs in total degree P minus 1. Right, so I guess I have to tell you that the degree here is 0, and the degree here is 1, the degree here is 2. So the degree here is 1 less than the number of indices, the standard degree in the Czech complex. Now, there are various properties to say about it. So one is that the standard Derome complex fits inside here as a subcomplex with one caveat. So namely, the standard Derome complex is just in the first column where everything else is 0. Right. If we had a global form, I could just stick that in the first column, just as we did the capital omega. You see, the capital omega is in there, but there are zeros that stretch there. So that's really the Derome complex sits inside, except that at the bottom, we've changed from real-valued functions to circle-valued functions. So we have to remember that important modification. Of course, we have d squared equals 0, if I remember the signs here. And we have the usual Leibniz rule. Well, I guess I can't talk about that yet. But we have d squared equals 0. And now, so we haven't really been considering objects which are closed in this total complex, because something closed in this total complex would mean that the vertical map was also 0. So that would be something here, like a bundle with zero curvature, a flat bundle. But we have these other objects where we allow curvature, but we don't allow anything like that. So we have this sort of intermediate object between differential forms and arbitrary cochains in this complex, which we might call theta p. So this is the set of all omega in gamma p, such that d omega is a differential form. So concretely, that means that when I take capital D and I shift up, I get all zeros except in the first column. And then the differential form I get is necessarily closed with integral periods. So this is necessarily closed and with integral periods. Now, these don't form a complex, but these are the things which behave like bundles with connection. So, for example, we might ask, what's something in theta 0? So something in theta 0 means that on each open set, I have a function gi. This is.
Yeah.
Okay. So this means that I have functions gi, and that the arrow here is 0, but the arrow here might be some global form omega. Well, what does that mean? That means that gi is a map in ui into the circle. And the arrow here says that the ratio gi over gj is equal to 0, except it's 1. So I have to alternate between additive and multiplicative notation, sorry. But in any case, that just means that gi is equal to gj on the overlaps. So of course, that means it fits together into a global map to the circle. So theta 0 are the set of maps. So theta 0 of M are the C infinity maps from M into the circle. So an element in theta 0 is just a circle-valued map. That's exactly the sort of thing that the effective action is, or any kind of action, if this is the space of fields. And of course, omega here is the curvature of such a thing. Well, what does the curvature mean? It's just the pullback of d theta, right? It's just dg over g for that map. Okay, so these are the connection-like objects, and we have curvature. I should also point out that such objects carry not only information in the real cohomology, but also integral information. So, well, it's not much of a statement here, but it is true that if you have a map from M to the circle, you get an integral first cohomology class. And if you have a circle bundle, then you know you get an integral second cohomology class, which is, of course, the Chern class. So there's also, so if omega is in theta p, then there's a characteristic class, C omega, which is a p plus one dimensional class over the integers. So these objects, even though represented by smooth objects, actually carry torsion information. Okay. Now, of course, we come to Robert's question. What are the objects in gamma which aren't in this theta? I mean, which don't have this. In other words, they're just sort of a general object. How am I supposed to think of that in this complex?
It's okay. Also, if you take a torsion test,
yes? Yes, so I'll say that in a second. So, sorry, what was I about to say? Yes. Right, so I think of these objects as, in a way, even though these aren't the closed objects, I think of them as analogous to closed differential forms. In other words, they carry some cohomological information, which I'll say in a second. Just as you see, for example, in these examples, that a map to the circle carries cohomological information, and a circle bundle carries cohomological information. And in general, these carry cohomological information, which I'll make precise in a minute. That's correct. If we have a one-form connection, the Chern class is a two-dimensional class.
Yeah, okay. I see.
So these carry cohomological information. They're somehow analogous to closed forms in Durham theory. But we'll see the cohomological information is not discrete, but it's rather continuous because it carries the curvature as an invariant here. And on the other hand, then, we should think of a general cochain here as being like an ordinary differential form, which is a non-closed differential form, possibly closed. So, of course, in geometry and physics, we use closed forms a lot in the cohomological information, but you also use non-closed forms. And so you might expect to see these more general cochains. Now, I think it's true that in a lot of contexts, physicists think about these p-forms as being these sorts of objects that I've described, generalizations of a gauge field. But you also run into cases where you should think of them as these general p-form, as these general p-dimensional cochains which aren't closed, these elements of gamma that aren't in theta. So let's look at an element of gamma 0 to see what it might be. So an element of gamma 0, well, instead of calling it G, I'll just call it H. So it's something which lives here. It's just a map to the circle on each open set. But in general, of course, it maps to something, Gij, and let's say alpha I, which for which the Gij isn't 0. Right? If the Gij were 0, that would be one of my elements of theta 0. That would be a global map to the circle. But here I allow a non-trivial Gij. So, of course, the object here... So not 1. So the object here is, of course, a one-dimensional object, and its derivative, since d squared is 0, its derivative is, of course, 0. So the two-dimensional object, d squared, is 0. So this, remember, represents a circle bundle with connection, but its derivative has 0 curvature. And, of course, you can see that that characteristic class is also 0. So in other words, it's the trivial line bundle with trivial curvature, trivial connection, flat connection, but I should say that it's trivializable. In other words, we don't, a priori, if I just give you this like that, I don't have a pick trivialization. But that's precisely what the HI is. So the HI is an explicit trivialization of this bundle. So a section of this bundle, you see, if I just present you this bundle, what's a section? It's a function on each open set, which when I transform, so it would be a function HI from UI to T, where for given Gij, Hi is equal to something like Gij times Hj on Uij. That's the definition of a section. That's how you constructed the bundle. You constructed it exactly the way I said you think about tensors, as local functions to the circle, which transform in a given way on the overlaps. Well, that's precisely the equation here that says Hi is, that the delta of it is Gij. It's precisely that equation. Never mind if I got the signs right. So that means that this circle bundle, so I forget the geometry here, the circle bundle comes with a trivialization. And what does this equation say? It says that dhi is equal to alpha I. And what that says, if you think about what's the covariant derivative in this patch, well, I'm supposed to take ordinary d but subtract alpha. I mean, that's the local connection form. So with the right sign, this being 0 says that this is a flat section. So what that says is that if dh is equal to alpha, so here h is in my gamma 0 and alpha is theta 1, then h is a global flat section of the bundle alpha. So I think of alpha as being a circle bundle with connection, and this H is a trivialization both of the bundle and of the connection. Yeah, sorry, I'm switching between the notations. So, you see, if this side were 0, then H would be a global function to the circle. And this is a sort of twisted version. It's not a global function to the circle, but it's a global function to a family of circles, this non-trivial circle bundle. But this family is trivial in some sense. It has a flat connection, and in fact, this section is flat. So I can't turn it into a function to the circle. I mean, I don't have any other trivialization that I can take the ratio with. So I'm just stuck with the fact that it has that interpretation. And we'll meet these p-form gauge fields, which really have that sort of interpretation. They're not gauge fields, but they rather behave like sections of a circle bundle. So I think that's one of the, really the main things I want to convey. First things I want to convey is that we have, so to speak, three levels of objects where we can see down in this complex what they are. And so I think of sort of gamma 0, theta 1, and omega 2. Those are the three different types of objects. This is a section of a circle bundle. This is a circle bundle. And in both cases with connection. And this is then the curvature. Okay. So for example, we might meet some equation. So if I call omega this object, I guess as I've been doing, then we would write the equation capital D omega equals omega that says that the curvature of this connection is capital omega. That's the sort of equation we've written. Now if we have a general section, let me just call it little h, then we might write the dh is equal to some form, some one form, let's say t, minus omega. We might write that. Before, we just wrote that dh was equal to omega, said that this was a flat section of that bundle. Well, now, if we really have it presented this way, of course, this is an element. This is meant, no, I'm sorry, I didn't say, to be a global one form. Not closed, but just a general one form. This is meant to be a connection form. So we know that we can change connections by adding global one forms. That's how we move from one connection to another. It's just an affine space. And so this combination T minus omega is just a new connection on the same bundle. And this equation says H is flat for that new connection. Or in other words, H is a section of the bundle whose covariant derivative, so to speak, is T, which is a one form. So in that way, you can encode a section which isn't flat by that sort of equation. And that's the typical kind of equation which you meet. So those are the three sorts of objects we had. We also had theta 0, which is a map from M to the circle. And then its curvature would be in omega 1. So that's the intuitive picture, the easiest intuitive picture I can give you for what a general object in this sort of double complex looks like. And that's how at least I'll think about p-form fields. Now, I want to say that I can play with this thing with all the rules of calculus, and there's the embarrassment because, well, I don't really know how to make a rigorous theory out of it. Maybe now I'll try a little bit harder. But one criticism you might say right away is that it depends on the cover. I mean, this model depends on a cover. Whereas when I do, for example, Durham theory, I have a notion of a global form. That's what I said at the beginning, that I have this global vector bundle. So here, I don't really know, and I don't know if that's a fruitful direction, to find the replacement for that. I should say in degree 1, we do have a global picture, which is the circle bundles with connection. And in degree 0, we have a global picture, which was just maps to the circle. In degree 2, and possibly even in degree 3, there is some mathematical work about global pictures due to Berlinsky and McLaughlin and other people, having to do with words like gerbs and so on. But I think those sorts of pictures will quickly run out when we get in dimensions higher. And we'll see we're going to get to 11 dimensions. Well, so I've tried to present it that way, I hope. No, I didn't say that. I said that the descriptions which were really meant to be global descriptions, following that line of thought would become quite complicated if I continue in that direction. I didn't say a rigorous description would be impossible. Okay. What he's trying to say is it involves the notion of higher categories, which I've tried to not say. Okay. Now, even the multiplication, which various forms of multiplication I might do in this model, but I have to confess that I haven't worked out the details. But the only kind of multiplication we'll really use is to multiply an element of this gamma by a closed form. And I think that sort of multiplication is fairly safe. The trickiest thing is also integration. So I want to tell you that I can integrate, and I can integrate in the same way that we do in Durham theory. And so in Durham theory, if we have a family of manifolds, say X over Y is some fiber bundle, and we have oriented fibers, and let's say omega is some differential form on X, then we can integrate over the fibers omega. And if the relative dimension here is p, so the fiber dimension is p, then we get a differential form of degree n minus p on the base y. Of course, if the base is a point, that's the usual integration of one of a single form on a single manifold. But here we can do it in families, and we have Stokes' theorem, which says that if I differentiate this form, I get that this is equal to the integral of the derivative. And then we get a boundary term, which, in general, the fibers might not be closed. I might have a boundary. And so you pick up, of course, the usual boundary term, which is the integral over the boundary. And there's a sign. Okay. The sign is plus, by the way, if we get a function down at the bottom. Then the sign alternates as you get higher. So, of course, I want to do integration like that with these funny objects. And let's just say that hasn't been worked out completely. Now, to say the least. Now, one thing which I meant to say to answer Ed's question, for example, and to relate it to other things, is what to say a little bit more about the cohomological significance of the theta p's, and then I'll go on to the physics. So the cohomological significance is that if I consider theta p, let's say, modulo d gamma p minus 1, so of course, if I take d of something, d squared is 0. In particular, d squared is a differential form. So d of something lands me inside this theta, and so I can consider the quotient. And as you see here, if I take a concrete circle bundle with connection, and if I mod out by d of something, well, d of something was just a trivial circle bundle with a trivial connection. So this quotient really means that I'm taking circle bundles with connections up to equivalence. And so here I'm taking the higher dimensional object up to equivalence. And that, then, is the cohomological notion. Now, we saw that we have a map here to the curvature. So this is the curvature. And then we also have this characteristic class with integral coefficients. So this is M. Okay, and this map is onto. So if you give me any topological type of bundle and you specify a curvature, you can actually find a connection on that bundle.
Yeah.
So, of course, I can't do that. But inside here, I need these things to be compatible. So if the curvature is omega, and this form is called, that class is lambda, then the compatibility condition is that the Durham class of omega is the real cohomology class of lambda. Sorry. So, I mean, I have to have a compatibility between them, of course. So what I really meant to say is that we map into here, and this maps to 0. Now, what's the kernel? Well, if we think of the case p equals 1, the kernel means that I have a circle bundle with flat connection, and which is also topologically trivial. And so that means it's an element of H1, or in general, HP of M, with real coefficients mod HP of M with integer coefficients. So that's a torus. So that's the torus of flat connections on the trivial bundle. So these objects, these cohomology classes, is a familiar object. So one name for them are called Cheeger-Simons differential characters. And those were introduced back in the 70s when Simons was still doing mathematics. And in the context of characters, of secondary characteristic classes, the sort of thing Chern and Simons were doing then. And it also sometimes goes by the name of smooth delinear cohomology. And I'll let Pierre fend for himself about that. Okay. So I can't swear, but... Right. Now, I really think of these things, as I say, as being sort of secondary characteristic classes. So I think I don't really have time to say much about that and still talk about the physics. So I won't, except to say that if we have something like trace F squared, which is, say, a closed four-form, and we think of also the integral cohomology class, then what this says is I can find a three-form up to some equivalence, which a three-form meaning a degree three object in this complex, which in a sense represents the Chern-Simons. And so if I would integrate that form, for example, over a three-dimensional manifold, I'd get down to my theta zero, and that's a function to the circle. And so the Chern-Simons invariant would be represented in that way. To really get a secondary characteristic class, which is in the top one, I would do it once and for all on the classifying space. Okay. Now, I was going to show you the Green-Schwarz mechanism to show you that third type of term, which occurs, but we'll see it in 11 dimension. And so, why don't we go on then to the physical application of these ideas. So everything else that I will say is joint work with Greg Moore, Jeff Harvey, and Ruben Manassian. Okay, so the rest of the talk is joint work with them. Now, what I want to discuss is actually something that Ed discussed in the first lecture, which is how we describe a magnetically charged object in a gauge field. And we're going to meet something which is, you know, high dimensional in 11 dimensions, which is magnetically charged with respect to some three-form field. And to get the intuition, I want to explain that in a low-dimensional case. So let's look at a particle in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So the particle has a world line, W, which is a one-manifold which sits inside our three-dimensional world. And it's electrically charged with respect to a one-form gauge field. That's true in any dimensions. And I wrote down before, you just integrate or take the holonomy along this line. That's the coupling. That's how you express that something is electrically charged. Well, if it's electrically charged with respect to one form, then it's magnetically charged with respect to the dual gauge field. Now, the dual of a one-form, the field strength of a one-form is a two-form, and the Hodge dual of a two-form is a one-form in three dimensions. And so that means that it's the field strength of a zero form. And a zero form, as I've said, is just a function to the circle. So when we have the topology, we want to think of the gauge field, I'll call C, as a function from M to the circle. So that's a gauge field. So let's leave out this magnetically charged object for a second. And the dual to an ordinary one-form gauge field, then, in three dimensions, is just a map to the circle. So that's something we can, I think, easily visualize. And it has a field strength. So, of course, this C in my notation is an element of theta naught of M. So it has a field strength, dC, which is equal to G. And G is now a one-form on M, which is closed and has integral periods. So that's analogous to the two-form field strength we normally think of a gauge field. Now, what we want to do is think of a magnetically charged object. And what that means is we're plucking down one of our museum particles, I suppose, which is really a magnetic monopole. So it'll have some magnetic charge. And as I said, it has a world line like this sitting in three dimensions. But let's just look at the picture for a fixed time. Something has to disappear. Right. So if we just look at the picture on a space slice, then what we're looking at in a space picture is we're looking at a two-manifold, say sigma 2, and inside we're just looking at a point, W. And now we have our gauge field, which is a map from this picture into the circle. And what does it mean for this thing to be magnetically charged? Well, what it means is that let's not define this map over this point, but let's demand instead that as I go around this point, that I have a winding number. Right? So magnetic charge, which is topological, as we've heard all through the week, is in this context just the winding number of this particle. So magnetic charge M is equal to the winding number. So we might think that the right description, then, is to describe C as a map to the circle, which is defined, so C is a map from sigma 2 minus this point into the circle. Now, I want to argue that that's not an adequate description of something magnetically charged, that it's not adequate to think of the C as only being defined off of here. Now, it is adequate if we just have, so to speak, one space-time, and we just consider that gauge field. Then, as far as I can tell, it's adequate. But when we have a family of space-times, then we're going to have to, in some way, describe how this description might vary as we vary the family of space-times. C is defined, no. I can't have a winding number here and extend the map over that point. That's the topological invariant. So the usual statement in four dimensions, so it's a three-dimensional space, is I have a monopole sitting here, I have a circle bundle with a non-trivial turn number around the linking sphere, and so I can't extend it into the point. Correct. So this C, I'm not going to write it because I'm going to change my description in a second, would be an element of theta 0 of M minus W. Okay. So what I want to say instead is that we can extend this thing over the point, but we have to abandon our wish that this C remain a map to the circle. So we can extend it over this point and in fact enforce in a way this winding number by asking that it be a section of some non-trivial circle bundle, and the circle bundle is twisted precisely over this point in such a way that sections have this winding number. So instead, so more globally, I don't know how to say it, more globally, we extend C to a section of a non-trivial circle bundle. Let's call it omega, with twist M. Now the circle bundle that encodes this twisting is completely separate from the gauge field. So it's something that's defined once I pluck that point down. Once I pluck that point down, before I put in any gauge field, I can describe not a gauge field, but I can describe, so to speak, where a gauge field will live by constraining how it's going to twist. In other words, encode in that picture the magnetic charge. Now, this sort of picture where I want to twist over a point is very good in algebraic geometry and quite canonical. So let me remind you of that picture. Now, the bundle will be over everything. So you see, well, it's non-trivial. Well, that's what I'm about to say. So we can't say it's topologically non-trivial if this is the plane, of course. I have to encode the non-triviality in some geometric structure. So I might encode it in a holomorphic way. Of course, I'm only giving a local description. You're going to tell me by global arguments I could untwist. But nevertheless, if you bear with me, we'll enforce it in some kind of local way with holomorphic structure, just as an analogy. But then we'll go back and use differential geometry to encode it using connections and curvature. So if you bear with me for a second, I'll show you how it's done.
You mean we should think of C as some kind of mirror moving function with a pole and a point?
Well, let me make the analogy. So just as an aside, so if sigma is a complex curve, a Riemann surface, then W is, well, really you want to think of a divisor, but we'll think of the picture with a point. Okay, so here's my sigma, here's my point W, and now we create a, instead of a circle bundle, we'll create a non-trivial line bundle, let's just call it L sub W, will be a holomorphic line bundle. No metric, just a holomorphic line bundle. And how do you describe it? Well, you want to say that you take a little open set near here, let's call it U0, and then we take U1 to be just the complement of the point. So U1 will be sigma minus W. And now we say that... Well, these are, so to speak, different U's, but you could refine the cover if you want. And so here we ask for pairs of functions, F0, F1, which are holomorphic functions to the complex numbers, so that F0 is equal to F1 times Z, so to speak, if Z is a local parameter, where Z equals 0 is the point W, Z to the power plus or minus M. Okay. Sorry. So that encodes that we have M twists, and that's the standard notion of what the how you build a holomorphic bundle from a divisor. But I want to point out two important features of this construction. So one is that we have a canonical trivialization. This equation, I should have said, was on U0 intersect U1. So we have a canonical trivialization trivialization on M minus W. So outside of this point, we have a canonical trivialization. Namely, I just take, on that point, I just have the single open set. That's why I took it. And we just let F1 be identically 1. And F0, then, is on that, is just defined by that equation. So this is a completely canonical trivialization. So we've really, in a way, encoded that that all the twisting occurs exactly over this point. In other words, if I had a section of this bundle, I could take the ratio with this canonical trivialization outside of that point. And then we would see the twisting in that function we would get. So the section is some more abstract object. It's not a function. But if I wanted to see the more concrete version of the gauge field, I would take the ratio with this canonical trivialization, get a map. Well, here I replaced the circle by the complex numbers, but I'd get a map there, and I would see this twisting. The second point is that this is also canonical in holomorphic families. Namely, here I've described, so to speak, how the thing twists by constructing this line bundle. But if I have a family of curves now, and I want to say how these things twist in a family, I'll get a family of these points, which is a divisor in the bigger thing. And again, I have a canonical way to construct that line bundle there. So that's a completely canonical construction, which, so to speak, couples the gauge field with the geometry of this thing. Now, what we want to do is the same construction, only in Riemannian geometry. Why Riemannian geometry? Because it's the Riemannian metric which appears in a theory of gravity. And so in this way, we'll see how to couple the magnetic gauge field. When I have a magnetically charged object, how to couple that gauge field to gravity. Okay. So before I go into that excursion, let me just summarize here, perhaps. By saying that the picture we'll arrive at, that we're aiming at, is that we construct some omega, which will be in theta 1 of, sigma, but m, really, the space-time, meaning that this magnetically charged thing will give me a bundle, in this case, an honest circle bundle, which encodes the twisting. Well, also, and this is global. I mean, it exists over W. We'll also have this canonical section. So sigma will be an element of gamma 0. Remember, that's a section. And I'll have the equation that d sigma is some sort of section of omega. Maybe it's minus omega the way I wrote it there. And this section will only exist, sorry, outside of W. So it's exactly the picture we have here, that we're canonically trivialized outside the divisor. And, well, this won't be a flat section, but it'll have some covariant derivative, mu. Mu will be an honest one form, won't be closed, but it will exist outside of W. Now, of course, d mu, that's a two form, closed two form, is the same as d omega. D omega is the curvature that encodes this. So we'll have some curvature. Let's call this equal to phi. And so phi will be in omega 2. That'll be global, because this omega is defined globally. So we'll have a global curvature. This will be closed and with integral periods. And so the integral over that submanifold will tell me how many units of magnetic charge I have. That's the curvature. So if we really thought of it as a delta function, we would think of this as being a delta function at that point, which would be a two-form, right? So since I'm in codimension 2, that phi would be a delta function. But instead, we're going to use the metric to spread it out. So, of course, we spread it out by constructing what's called a Thom form. So it's a Thom form, which tells you how the submanifold sits in, and it's a form which, when you integrate over that neighborhood, gives you generally 1. Of course, we can multiply it by m for magnetic charge m. So this is the picture before I introduce any gauge field. So that's just from the geometry, except we're going to make all these things depend on the metric. So everything here will be a function of the metric. And then we'll have our C field, which will be C is now here. Instead of a map to the circle, it will be a global section of this bundle omega. So away from this point, I can just think of omega as being trivial, and this is, again, a map to the circle. But near that point, it has to twist. And so, of course, its equation is that dc, well, it has a field strength g, G was the field strength we had before, which is a one form, but now it's not necessarily closed. It'll be closed away from this point, but it won't be closed near here. And so this is G minus omega, which says it's a section of omega. So it's a section of omega with sort of field strength G, but it's not necessarily closed there. But G is closed. So that's really the picture of the gauge field. And now how do we recover this picture of a map to the circle outside that point? Well, we simply take G. Pardon me? I didn't mean to say G is closed. Global, if I, yeah. G is global.
Not closed.
In general, near here. It's closed outside of the neighborhood of here, but it's not closed near here. But you see, I have to take the difference of that with this trivialization to recover my map to the circle. So C minus sigma is then a global map to the circle. Not global, sorry. It's a map to the circle, but off of W. And of course, his field strength, D, of C minus sigma, is equal to G minus mu, and this is now a closed one form with integral periods. So the C minus sigma is the usual picture you have of a gauge field defined off of this magnetically charged object. But I've encoded this twist of how this thing has to twist over the magnetically charged object, which, as I say, for a single space, I don't think would add much. But when we have a family of spaces, we'll see that it adds something in this particular problem in M-theory. Okay. So now we need to say how to construct these things canonically from a metric. So that's a purely mathematical digression. But in view of the time, I'm going to have to say it rather quickly so I can get to the M-theory. So this is a digression about constructing this explicit tone form. So let's imagine that we have a bundle over M, a W, sorry. So you want to think of this as the normal bundle to a submanifold. So in our situation, we're going to be in higher dimensions. We're going to have an 11 manifold for the 11 manifold of M-theory, and we're going to have what's called a 5 brain. So the world line of a 5 brain, very confusingly, is a 6 manifold. And so that 6 manifold sits in M, and you should think of E as the normal bundle to W, which is then a bundle along there. M has a metric, it's a Riemannian manifold. And so this normal bundle then, they're just the normal planes. I can take inner products of normal vectors. So this thing has a metric in a canonical way, depending on the metric of M. And it also has a connection, which is just the projection of the Levi-Civita connection.
Definite.
Riemannian. If it weren't Riemannian, then W would point a long time, and in any case, these normals would have a definite metric, so I think. And, okay, so what you should think of E, of course, is that the total space of E is just a local picture around W inside M. Right. So we can think of that as that local picture. So we'll identify a neighborhood of the zero section with that neighborhood. And now we want to construct this tome form and so on. And so if we look at, let's say, E naught is equal to E minus the zero section. So this is a neighborhood of, so to speak, M minus W. It's a neighborhood of W inside. Well, anyway, it's a picture of M minus W near W. How do I say that? And so on here, you see, we have the following picture. So supposing that we fix some point here, and now we just look in the normal fiber. So here's a picture, then, of the normal fiber. So we have the point at zero, which we've omitted. And now at any other point, we can split off a radial line. So at any other point, we have a well-defined line sitting inside that normal, which is just the radial line. And so therefore, we have the perpendicular F. Now, the geometry here depends very much on whether this is even or odd rank, in other words, even or odd codimension. Here we're in codimension 5, so let me just do it in that case to get the numbers right. And so here we have a four-dimensional plane bundle. So over this E naught, we actually have a rank 4 bundle, which is just E, but the complement in E to these radial fibers. So now this is a four-plane bundle, and this has, therefore, an Euler class. It's an oriented four-plane bundle. Everything's oriented, I should have said. And so we get an Euler class. So let's let E be the Euler class. Now, we can represent the Euler class, of course, by a differential form. And so I want to let E be the differential form. So this is now a four form on E naught. So this is the Euler form. So in other words, it's given as the Pfaffian of the curvature. So again, this is a subbundle of the sort of bundle along the fibers. It inherits a metric and connection, therefore a curvature. And I want E to be the Pfaffian of that curvature, this Euler form. Okay. And now we have the following sort of formulas, which are recent formulas of Rollbach, and in fact, crucial to this problem here. And they appear in a joint paper of Bott and Cottoneo, which I'm guessing is like this. So the first formula is that if I take E squared, which is not the Pfaffian of the curvature, but the determinant of the curvature, then essentially because I've split the bundle into this even rank piece, which is non-trivial, and this odd rank real line bundle, which doesn't contribute, that's essentially the same as the determinant of the curvature downstairs, which would have given us the second Pontryagin class. So this is the second Pontryagin class of the bundle E. So this is an 8 form. What am I saying? Yeah, this is an 8 form down on W. Hold your complaints for 1 second. Now, pardon me? Right. So you're going to all complain in 1 second before I can stop you. So E naught, let's call the projection of E naught, So let's call pi the projection of this onto W. And I want to say that, of course, I pull it back, and now both sides are closed 8 forms upstairs. And they're not equal, but they differ by an exact form. So this is the first formula. Now you're going to immediately complain that that doesn't make any sense because everything is low dimensional. Or maybe it does make sense. Well, P2 should be 0 because W is 6 manifold. But we're going to look at this thing in families, right? We're going to look at an anomaly situation where this is in families. And so you want to think of a parameter family of such things. Okay. The second formula is that if I now take inside of here some sphere bundle for some radius epsilon, and let's just call this map now pi, all right, pi epsilon, then if I push forward this class E squared, well, if I push forward a class from the base and I integrate over the fibers, I have no differentials in the fiber direction, so I certainly get 0. But here I get 0 up to an exact, pushing down an exact form, and the formula is I get 0 on the notes. So these are all formulas in differential forms. And the third formula is that if I integrate over the sphere bundle, E cubed, well, that's E times the pull-up of P2. The integral of E over the fibers is 2 because the Euler characteristic of the sphere is 2. So this is twice P2. And that's going to be the crucial formula. Now, these formulas all hold on the nose, rather. So they hold in cohomology is very easy to see. And the reason they hold on the nose is that each side of these formulas is a functorial differential form produced from the metric and connection. And the only functorial differential form which is exact is 0, and the only one which is functorial in the and in this cohomology class is the Chern-Weil form. So there's actually that sort of proof of that formula. Okay, well now what we want to do is construct the Thom form. And so what we do is we fix a function of the radius, which starts at -1 and goes something like that. So this is a function rho of r. And let's let mu equal to rho of r times e over 2. And let's let phi, the Thom form, be the differential of mu. So this mu is going to be a four form, no longer closed on this e naught. And this phi is going to be a five form on e. And this is closed. Okay, so I don't really have time to go into details, but the important picture here is that if I draw W from some kind of section, where W is just a point, and I look now in a neighborhood of W, that I want to know where's the support of this Thom form. In other words, I wanted to encode how a gauge field twists over this W, so I have to see where I've put the twist. That's in the Thom form. Well, the twist is in the support of phi. That's the curvature. But if you differentiate phi, you differentiate this, E is closed, so all I get is d rho wedge E over 2. But of course, d rho just means rho prime dr, and this is meant to be flat there. So d rho is just a little bump function like this. In particular, it's supported away from r equals 0. So the support of the thumb form is in some sort of annular region like this. So this is the support of phi. So in a way, we're going to have our cake and eat it too, because we're going to have a trivialization of this bundle, which encodes this twisting, which is good right up to w. And on the other hand, we have that near w, this bundle is flat. So we're going to have both those things working for us. All right. So that's the picture of this thumb form. And now what we want to do is, of course, just transfer it to the manifold, which we can do as long as rho is sufficiently good. And so we have exactly this picture that I told you before, except in higher dimensions. So phi, the place you start, is that this is a global phi form, which is closed with integral periods. We're going to have omega sub phi, which is going to be an element of theta 4. So that's like the theta 1. Everything is jacked up. So now we have to think of some kind of bundle which twists. This is also global. This is global. And d of this is going to be equal to phi. So this is like the secondary characteristic class. And again, we have to do this once and for all universally. Then we're going to also have a trivialization. That'll be an element of gamma 3 of m off of w. And we're going to have this form mu, which we already have. That's this 4 form off of w. And we're going to have the crucial equation that d sigma is equal to mu minus omega phi. And that's the equation I tried to write above, saying we have a trivialization right up to w. Okay. Now, Raoul is frowning, which he should be, because there's a factor of 2 that I've really... There's a topological obstruction to doing exactly that, and I've ignored a factor of 2 in saying that I could find such a thing. Well, I'm going to be ignoring all such factors and being allowed to divide these things. I guess that's right. And so I'll comment at the end of the computation about these factors. So with differential forms, I can divide, but these theta-like objects and related cousins carry cohomological information, integral cohomological information, so I can't really divide. All right. Maybe I should get this right. So now the gauge field, according to this interpretation, is an element. It's a three-form field, but it's not one of these connection-like objects, but it's rather the section-like objects because it has to twist over this magnetic thing. So it's defined globally, but it twists. Its field strength is going to be a 4-form, but it's no longer, of course, closed. And the equations are that dc is equal to g minus omega phi. That encodes the twist and says simultaneously that its field strength is g. And, of course, dg is then just by applying d to both sides. And since d squared is 0, that has to be the thumb form phi. Okay. In particular, of course, this last equation says that phi has to be 0 in cohomology. The thumb form is 0. That's the statement somehow that the total magnetic charge, if we had lots of these things, is 0. We also have c minus sigma, which is now going to be a global sort of preform connection type object that you used to. But it's not global, I mean. But it's only defined on the complement of w. And his field strength is g minus mu, which is a closed form. So that's the picture. And again, notice we have the following sort of picture in the neighborhood of w. So in the neighborhood of w, we have the support of the thumb form here. And near w, then, I have that dg is equal to phi. So near w, I have g is closed. And of course, mu is also closed. But mu isn't global, but g is global. G extends over w, in other words, but mu doesn't extend over w. Okay. So now, finally, we can see this term. So I should say that Ed Witten wrote a paper about a year ago called, quite interesting paper with many things in it, called the effective five-brain effective action in M theory, where he considered all the different contributions, and as I said at the beginning, there are three types, and here we really have all three types, to some sort of effective action in this 11-dimensional supergravity in this M theory. And when he computed the in my language, the curvature and so on, there was one term that didn't cancel, which was P2 of this normal bundle, that's what I called E, divided by 24. And so what we see now with this picture of magnetic coupling is how to cancel that. Now, the term in the Lagrangian, which is relevant, is the following term. So first of all, with no 5-brain, so this is a case when the anomalies do cancel, then there's a term in the 11-dimensional supergravity action, which is C wedge DC wedge DC. Now, with no 5-brain, you see we don't have any phi or omega or sigma or mu, and so C is just a global connection-like object that, which is how I think you think about the three-form field, and G is its field strength, which is a closed four-form with integral periods. That's usually called G over 2 pi, but I'm omitting that. So this is usually written C wedge G wedge G. So this whole thing, if I multiply something in theta 3 by an 8 form, this will be something in theta 11. And that, when I integrate over a 11 manifold, will produce a number mod 1, a map to the circle, if I have a parameter family, element of theta 0 of the parameters. So that's a typical Chern-Simons type term. Now, right, C isn't a differential form, but it's one of these connection-like objects, just as Chern-Simons would be something I would interpret here. So I get an 11-dimensional Chern-Simons by multiplying this 3-dimensional thing by a closed form. That's this sort of 11-dimensional Chern-Simons. And so his integral will make sense then up mod 1, just as the usual Chern-Simons. And you can, in this case, of course, over a single manifold, just define that using the sort of tic-tac-toe complex, as I was saying. Now, what's the modification with the 5-brain? Well, then we have these funny sorts of objects here. But remember that we have this object C minus sigma, which is the picture of how a gauge field looks. In our low-dimensional analogy, that was really a map to the circle, an honest gauge field. So this will be an honest three-form type connection, but it's defined on the complement of W. But that's clearly the thing that has to replace C in that picture. And of course, notice that this sigma, let me just write it once, depends on the metric. That was this explicit construction. So this L11 is now C minus sigma, depending on the metric, wedge D of C minus sigma, depending on the metric, wedge D of C minus sigma, depending on the metric. So this term now couples this three-form gauge field to the metric. So C and G are still independent. As presented here, they're independent fields. But we have to think of C in this way. I really don't know how else to think of it. And if you think of the field as only being defined on the complement, which is the C minus sigma, then that thing is not an independent field. It's somehow coupled to the metric. And I don't know how to think of that as an independent field, and that's precisely what shows up as being a contribution to the anomaly when I move the metric. Well, now if we want to calculate... Right. Not tall enough. So I should have said that this thing is now the same sort of object. You see, this thing is now in theta 3 off of W. This is now a closed form off of W. And so this whole thing is an element of theta 11 again, but it's on M minus W. So it's this Chern-Simons type object, but it's only defined in the complement of W. That's okay. We can just integrate it to get an action by integrating off of W. But with Chern-Simons type things, we better integrate over a manifold with boundary. And so again, if you... So what we would say is that that contribution to the action is the limit, as epsilon goes to 0, of the integral over M, where I remove some ball neighborhood of W. So that means just pick a ball bundle around W of radius epsilon of precisely this term. And now that's a Chern-Simons on a manifold with boundary. And so this we know is a section of some line bundle when I have parameters. And now this, what's that? Well, again, I'm sorry, the notation is, all right. I don't know how to get the notation right. What do you want me to say? This is defined as a point of norm 1 inside a Hermitian line. And when I have the parameter space, which here is the parameter space of C fields and metrics, I guess. then this thing will be a section of some line bundle. It'll have unit norm, so it won't contribute any topology, but it will have curvature. And the way we compute the curvature is just by using Stokes' theorem in this sort of calculus. So let me just say what the formula is. The curvature will just come from sort of boundary term. And so the curvature will be the integral over the boundary, which is some sphere bundle around W, of, well, it's not DL, but if I compute DL, this is equal to, yeah, it's DL. What am I saying? It's just DL. So in other words, it's the integral, it's the limit, sorry, as epsilon goes to 0. So this is the limit of, it's just G minus omega cubed. The curvature of, so I have to think of this thing, for fixed epsilon, this thing is a section of some line bundle with connection, and I want to compute the curvature of that thing will be a contribution to the anomaly, which I started at the beginning by explaining that's how I'm going to think about these effective actions and anomalies. So here there are four different types of terms which occur, so let's just analyze each one in turn. The integral of this, even for a fixed epsilon, is 0. Because remember, near W, G is closed, and it extends over W. So this is a closed 12 form, and this extends over. So that will give me 0 by Stokes' theorem. Again, when I write the integral over this, this is an 11 manifold, and I'm integrating, have I gotten confused? This is a 10 manifold, and I'm integrating a 12 form. But I have to integrate it in a parameter family, or I'm not seeing anything. So what I'm getting is a 2 form on the parameter space. And, but I'm not writing in the parameter space. I'm just writing the integrals that way. Now, another type of term we get is when I integrate, so I guess the next one might be when I integrate G wedge mu, and that thing occurs with a plus sign 3 times, I guess. And now we, see, we have that G extends over W. So G has a good limit as I get to W, and I can write this as 3 times the integral, so this is over S epsilon, times the integral of the pullback of G, let's say I star is the inclusion, so I is the inclusion of W. So what this says is that if I restrict to W and then sort of pull back over this normal neighborhood, I get a form which is roughly constant, which is constant in the fiber directions, and so I could try to integrate that, mu squared, and then I'll get an error term, which will be of order epsilon, because the form is not quite smooth. It's not quite the pullback, I mean. Now, I should have said that this mu is not only closed near nearby, but actually mu is equal to minus e over 2, right? Because of the formula there. It's rho times e over 2, and rho nearby is minus 1. Now, one of the formulas, which I said was crucial, is that the integral, the push forward of mu squared, which is now e squared up to a factor, is 0. So this first term actually integrates exactly to 0, and so this thing is order epsilon, and so that goes to 0 on the limit. So that term disappears where we use crucially this formula. Well, let me leave up those formulas. So now we have two more terms which won't go to 0. So third type of term will be now where I have two g's and one mu, that'll occur with a minus sign. So I get minus 3, the integral of, what did I say? Two g's and one mu. Again, we can approximate g wedge g as being constant pulled back, and so then I'm just integrating mu over the fibers, but the integral of mu over the fibers, since it's minus e over 2, is minus 1, and so the minuses cancel, so I guess I get 3 times the restriction of g wedge g to the brain. So that's an 8 form contribution to the anomaly, which is the restriction of G wedge G to the brain. Now, I don't have time to show you where that's canceled. That was already canceled in Ed's paper by something coming from the brain. In fact, by one of these Green-Schwartz sort of terms. The last term is the new one, and that's the term which is minus the integral of mu cubed over there. And now mu cubed is a closed form. So as I change epsilon nearby, this integral doesn't change. So this is an exact formula. And here we have the formula. All right, so mu is e over 2. So in total, I get something like P2 of e, the normal bundle, over 4. The The good news is that in the Lagrangian, in the right normalization, this whole Turn-Simons term has a minus 1/6 in front of it, and so this becomes minus P2 over 24 and precisely kills the missing term. Of course, I should end there. If I were more dramatic, and if you want to get to lunch. So let me just make one comment, which is that here we've computed the local anomaly, and so it's okay to do these divisions. In other words, the way I would say it is we just multiply everything by the right factor, and we just compute the anomaly in some power of the e to the is, and the curvature will just then be multiplied. So it's no problem in a local anomaly to do that. Now, what's the right factor? Well, there was a factor of 2 hidden in the fact that this mu wasn't really defined in the section sigma. So since I cubed it, there's a factor of 8 there, and there's a factor of 6 in saying that this term was really minus 1/6. So really, there's a factor, as far as I can tell, of 48, interestingly enough, which I would have to multiply everything by from the physical situation to get a computation that really made sense in this framework. Now, we know from, you know, history with K-theory and such good things that there are nice integrality theorems which allow you to do those divisions, where I think of these things perhaps not coming from cohomology, but some more sophisticated theory which allows me to construct these objects. So I think there's some interesting topology, I'm not sure if it's K-theory or something beyond, that allows you to construct the real line bundle here, because all I could construct really is 48 times it. So if you want to check out a global anomaly, you can't anymore take those roots, because you're asking integral cohomology questions, and then you would have to know something finer about the story. Okay, I'll stop there. Question?
How are you using the term anomaly in this context? Except there's no power of Fermion.
Well, so this is a funny type of term that can contribute to an anomaly. As far as I know, it's actually the only example I know of. A Turn-Simons type term, usually you think of a manifold with fixed boundary, and you fix the boundary conditions, so there's no sort of anomaly. But here you're on a closed manifold, but because of this magnetically charged thing, you meet this Turn-Simons term, but which really takes values in the line, and so then it contributes to the curvature. So the term anomaly is just because, from this point of view, the action makes sense in a gauge invariant way as a section of some line bundle, and we need to trivialize it. Now, you could say it by saying these fields transform under some gauge transformation, and I tried to write something that was a number, and so on. That's
so that's
equivalent.
To do with just add something, which is that you didn't explain where the uncanceled
term
that
calculus came
from.
Well, I didn't
explain.
Well, in fact, if I may say, I mean, it is true that those sorts of terms contribute to the anomaly. So there are chiral fermions, there is a chiral boson, but this specific term is actually canceled by a certain coupling between the C field, when I restrict it to W, which I can do, by the way, because of the shape of the tone form, and between the self-dual 2 form there. And that term is actually a Green-Schwarz type term, so that was the second type of term. And it's actually precisely the anomaly in that term which cancels this, but I think. Other questions?
Then you're saying with this analysis, it's slightly wrong, right? The 48.
It's okay over the reals. I mean, what physicists would call local anomaly means the curvature. But, you know, we might have pi 1 in the parameter space, and we might want to investigate some sort of whole anomaly. And so that's a global anomaly, and for that, you would need something more precise. I think for the local anomaly, this is fine. No.
You said that the tone form, it's not the case by the existence of a defect that it vanishes.
That would prove it vanishes over the... Yes, it is the case that it vanishes over the integers, because I've said it's not the existence of the G field, really, but the C field. So this object I called omega is, remember, analogous to something like a circle bundle, which carries integral cohomology information. And his integral characteristic class is the five-dimensional tone form is an integral class. And saying that I have a global section of that, which is what a gauge field is, says that that vanishes over the integers. So it's true that that vanishes. So in that sense, I suppose I could write that, and maybe it's only a factor of 6. I have to think more closely about that. You're right. It might be that. Yeah?
There's a perfectly good solution of a low-dimensional supergravity describing this bi-ray in which the C, or that is the G, is just a 4 form proportional to the volume form on a unit force here. Now, is there something wrong with that?
Well, here's where, even though this is a conference of mathematicians and physicists, we all have our identity in a complete innocence. So, the model that I was given, reading Ed's paper, for example, to calculate was, I was supposed to think of the analog of, as I learned this morning, a museum particle, although this is a museum brain, where I think of really putting in this very heavy external thing inside this theory and seeing how it affects it. That's certainly the picture that I have, just like we put a magnetic monopole. Now, a different model might be to investigate these solitonic smooth solutions, and then leave it up to you to tell me how the two are related.